This is Bob Wilson on the Shake and Wake Network. We're on the Don't Pass Me By show. We have two excellent guests today. Our old friend, Professor Joseph McBride, joins us, and also Max Good, who's made a wonderful documentary that you have to learn all about. We'll try to bring that information to you today. Welcome to the show. First, Joseph, how are you? And please tell us what's going on with you. What are your new works coming out, and how are things going?
Hi, Bob. It's good to be back with you and talk to Max Good. I have a recent book that came out called Political Truth, The Media and the Assassination of President Kennedy, which I've been working on for a long time. I'm very pleased with it. It's available from Amazon. And I earlier wrote Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit, which keeps selling, and a lot of people around the world have been buying it for years. And so anyway, it's been a lifelong activity for me. I was a volunteer for John F. Kennedy in the Wisconsin presidential primary campaign and met him twice then and once when he was president. So I've been following his career and with great interest in researching the assassination ever since it happened, actually. So I'm very happy to be back with you and talk to you and Max Good.
Well, we're glad to have both of you here. And Into the Nightmare is, I think, one of the best books on the assassination of President Kennedy, especially because it focuses on the case of J.D. Tippit, which had never really been hashed out to any degree with integrity. And Joseph did so to a great degree, and he did bring that integrity. And he had some interviews in there that you won't find anywhere else. Now we welcome to the show Mr. Max Good. How are you today? And thank you for being here.
Hey, Bob. Great to be on the show. I'm doing well. I'm here in San Antonio at the film festival, and my movie just played last night. It's called The Assassination and Mrs. Payne, and it was 7 years in the making, and it explores some of the intriguing connections and the questions and accusations around Ruth and Michael Payne and their involvement with the whole assassination story.
Well, I got a chance to see that, and I thought you also did an excellent piece of work, especially because you gave both sides a voice, both sides from either side of the aisle, of conspiracy or non-conspiracy, got a chance to speak, and you certainly gave Mrs. Payne an open microphone and a chance to answer any information, questions you had. I thought you did a fantastic job. But Joe McBride, when you're here, it's like we're bringing in a ringer. So I'm going to hand this off to you, and you can start in with Max. And I'm here with you, too. So please take it away, Joseph.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'm a great admirer of Max's film. I saw it again last night, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Again, it's a really superb piece of work. And I agree with what you say, that Max strives very fully to be fair and try to present both sides, and he lets the audience make up our own minds about Mrs. Payne, which I think is a good strategy, because it's more effective, and it lets the audience think for themselves. But he asks her a lot of pointed questions, and he presents all the important issues, and he got her to talk, which is remarkable on film, and she's very articulate. She's in her 80s, but a very sharp person, and it's just full of insights. And one thing about the film that I think is remarkable, it sparked a lot of interest. It's a modestly budgeted, film that Max worked on for a long time, and I got to know Max while he was in the earlier stages, and we talked about Mrs. Payne and all the issues, and he did a fantastic job. It looks beautiful and really well done, but it's provoked pros and cons, which I think is a good sign, because it struck a nerve. So I would start by asking Max about that. It's got a lot of positive reviews, but there's some people who predictably are attacking the film on various assassination forums and other places, and I believe Max has even heard from a couple of people associated with the Warren Commission. And Mrs. Payne has always been a staunch defender of the Warren Commission and believes that Oswald did it alone. She was the person who, maybe Max can tell us what her role was, and then talk about the media reaction to the film, if you would.
Yeah, so for people who don't know, Ruth Payne was sort of a friend and benefactor of Marina and Lee Oswald. She met them 9 months before the assassination and befriended Marina specifically and invited Marina and her baby to come live with her. And so Marina moved in to Ruth Payne's house 2 months before the assassination. Lee Harvey Oswald would spend the weekend there, and all the Oswald's belongings were, most of them were stored in Ruth Payne's garage. And Ruth is involved with some of the key evidence in the case. The rifle was, you know, the alleged rifle was stored in her garage. And the story is that Oswald came out the night before the assassination and picked up the rifle from there and then got a ride to work and shot the president. Also, Ruth Payne had a key role in getting Oswald his job at the Texas School Book Depository. The story is through a neighbor who mentioned there might be a job available, but Ruth was the one who actually made the call to the book depository and set up the connection, the interview with Oswald. Other evidence was found in her house, the backyard photos, and she also had some involvement with something called the Walker note, which was a note that the Warren Commission cited as a piece of evidence to show that Oswald tried to kill this right-wing general, Edwin Walker, several months before the assassination. And another letter that Oswald wrote to the Soviet embassy, Ruth has had a role in finding that and giving it to the FBI. And there are lots more details, you know, more than I could fit in the film or more than we can even talk about today, I'm sure.
Yeah, you do touch on the main areas, which is extremely valuable to get her on film. And we get to spend time with her. She lives in a retirement community in Northern California, and she's a Quaker, and it's a Quaker retirement home. And she's always had this try to promote a public image of being a benevolent person who just took them in. But the people who are on the opposite side believe she's a CIA asset of some kind, if not an agent, and was a babysitter for the Oswalds, for the agency, and helped get him in place for the assassination to be the fall guy, the patsy, and then produce all this evidence out of her garage, which I can talk about that. I saw her at a public event and asked her a question about the evidence. The evidence kept pouring out of her garage even after the police and the sheriff's department had thoroughly combed the home. More things kept coming out very conveniently, and so she, as you say, she got Oswald the job or helped get him the job and put him in position on the motorcade route. So it's maybe you could tell us, before we get into the feedback on the film, how did you get her to talk and be so cooperative? I really admire that you did that. It must have been difficult and required some diplomacy.
Yeah, I had heard about her through reading this book, JFK and the Unspeakable, and then somehow learned that she's still alive and she was living not far from me in Northern California. And I just thought, this story is amazing. I mean, here people are saying that, you know, she and her husband have links to the CIA. They were involved with, you know, sort of maneuvering Oswald. I mean, this is a pretty serious accusation here. Is it true, or is this stuff all made up? And I thought, you know, somebody should explore this through a film. So I found her contact information and reached out. And I was a grad student studying documentary at the time, and this was my thesis project. It started out as a 20-minute film I made in 2015, and I just kept working on it from there. But I was open with Ruth that I wanted to explore these accusations. You know, there are a lot of, usually if you see anything about Ruth Payne online in an interview or, you know, if she's in some film, they don't broach this topic. It's a little too uncomfortable, or people consider it offensive. But, you know, this stuff is out there and she knows it. It's, some of it is covered in the only book about her, which is called Mrs. Payne's Garage by Thomas Mallon, he's an official story guy, and he believes Ruth is not guilty of lying or anything. But he does cover some of these accusations. So I thought this needs to be aired. This story needs to be heard, and you know, maybe we can come to a better conclusion and see, did, you know, separate the rumors and the allegations from the factual basis of what's actually going on.
Mm-hmm. As a researcher myself, and I've called and talked to many witnesses, and some are cooperative and some are not, but what, did you just call her out of the blue originally, and what? How did that work out?
Yeah, I think I maybe emailed her first. She was very open. I didn't know it at the time, but she actually is generally open to doing interviews with almost anyone, unless they're, you know, extremely rude. If you go in saying, you know, you're lying about this, or you're a CIA agent, you know. I've heard she's walked out of interviews like that. But as long as you're respectful and you know you ask reasonable questions, I think she's open to talking to most people. She has talked to people like David Talbot and Russ Baker, and I think other people who are, you know, on the conspiracy side. And, I think she appreciated that I was a student at the time. She thought she was, you know, helped me out doing this project. I waited until later to ask the more uncomfortable questions. As you see in the film, you know, it kind of progresses. And, you know, I didn't want to offend her or, you know, be rude or anything, but some of this stuff, it had to be asked, you know, these questions are out there, and to get her responses on the record on video, I thought was important.
Yeah, that's a good technique. I've done that myself with sensitive people. You start off with the easy questions or the friendly ones, and then you move into the more difficult ones once you've established some kind of rapport. And I think people appreciate it if you know the subject well and you've done your homework, and you certainly did, and she responded to that. But one thing I find valuable is you just get time to spend time with her and watch her, and you have a lot of really good close-ups in the film where the camera just studies her face, and you can try to examine her face. John Ford was asked once how to watch a movie. He said, look at the eyes. That's the secret of people, is revealed in their eyes. And so when she answers a question, you'll let the camera linger on her, and sometimes her eyes kind of shift around, and you could possibly read things into it, but it's ambiguous in the sense that there is no firm answer. There are documents about the Payne family, and Michael's family, her late husband, was a Forbes, from the very wealthy Forbes family, very socially prominent people in New England, and he was even related to John Kerry, who's part of that whole clan, and they went to an island. You talk about that, which is fascinating, called Noshan Island. Could you talk about that? Because that's, in your film, a central image of a possible nexus of connections with powerful people who might have led the Paines to be the babysitters of Oswald and Marina.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think it's important, you know, that the film is balanced and allows the audience to decide for themselves, or, you know, and I didn't want to tip the scales too much. And I intentionally put some of the ambiguity in there to sort of, you know, have the audience, whether you're coming on a pro conspiracy side or the anti, you have some, you know, some voices that are, expressing your side, and you're like, you don't feel too alienated. And also you're not quite sure what the perspective of the film is, or my perspective, which I think is good. It keeps people on their toes and keeps them thinking for themselves and watching critically. And, you know, I think a lot of people go into the film with a certain paradigm, and, you know, I'm not sure hearing whatever's in the film will change it that much. Maybe there'll be, you know, they might start questioning something here and there. But usually, unless you, this is all kind of new to you, if you have a strong opinion either way, it might not sway you. And that's fine. But as long as you're watching and you're taking in the information, I think that's good. So as far as Noshan Island goes, it's this private island owned by the Forbes family since the 1800s. The Forbes family was involved in, you know, the opium trade and made, you know, a big chunk of their fortune that way. And yeah, Michael Paine's mother was a Forbes, and he spent vacations there since he was a kid. It's just, you know, it's kind of a, this is kind of a classic conspiracy approach where you trace people's lineage and their family and the connections. And I did that with Noshan Island, and, you know, saw some Michael Paine's ancestors. It's an interesting place because Michael Paine's mother was very close friends with this woman named Mary Bancroft, who was a spy and was the mistress of Alan Dulles for many years, and, you know, was in touch with him and writing letters to him. So some people see that as a, you know, very suspicious connection, that we know that even Mary Bancroft and Alan Dulles were invited to come stay on this island. And I could never verify if Alan Dulles actually went there. Somebody else can dig up that information. I'd love to know. Yeah, Ruth Paine visited Noshan Island the summer of 1963 in August, I believe. She also visited her, she went on this long road trip around the country in late summer, fall of 63. And she went to Noshan Island. She visited her sister, who was a confirmed CIA employee, in the DC area. She also visited her, her mother-in-law and Michael's mother and her husband in Pennsylvania. Her husband was Arthur Young, very interesting guy who invented the Bell helicopter, like the first commercially viable helicopter, and very wealthy people. You know, the mother was a Forbes, and Arthur Young came from a wealthy family. And then on the last stop of this trip, Ruth Paine picks up Marina Oswald in New Orleans and brings her back to Dallas to live with her. and that's when people, you know, they suppose that Oswald's rifle was packed in one of these bags that went into Cleve's car. So lots of connections. Lots of different things to chew on. Whether people see these things as, you know, coincidences or indicative of something nefarious, that's up to them to decide.
Can I jump in here?
Yeah, John, Bob, you want to jump in? Sure.
Thanks, Joe. I just wanted to bring something up. One thing is minor. It jumped out at me watching your excellent documentary, was when General Walker was on screen, behind him there was a, you know, bullet hole in the wall. And I was just thinking, you know, after the police came and investigated, took their pictures, got the slug, etc., as it happened, he said he got three little wounds in his arms, or three, you know, arm wounds. After that was over, I think in a day or two, I'd want to patch my wall so I didn't think about someone shooting at me in my, you know, in my den. Did you think it was a little strange that he left that bullet hole there after that happened? He would, you know, have no idea that someone would, you know, this would be somehow related to JFK if this was all innocent. I thought that was a little weird.
Yeah, you might see that as strange. I don't know how long after the shooting that interview was, but it did seem like it was probably a ways after it. I mean, some people speculate that Walker might have set up this shooting as a publicity stunt, or he could have had some involvement with Oswald. That's all speculation as far as I know. Walker, though, he was involved with distributing those wanted for treason posters with Kennedy on them in right. Dallas. You know, he's an arch right wing John Birch guy, and he hated Kennedy. And he even became kind of a suspect in the assassination. So it's, you know, all those connections are pretty strange.
And there was
he
just
was relieved of command by Kennedy in Germany. He was commanding American troops, and he was indoctrinating them with John Birch Society material, which you're not supposed to do in the military. So Kennedy relieved him of command, and he resigned from the army, and so he had a real enmity toward the Kennedys.
And the a follow-up to that one, I just, when you covered George de Morenschildt, a very mysterious character, possible ties to the Nazis during World War II, seemed to be possibly another handler of the Oswalds. But in that story, an ear witness to the assassination was, or his death, I apologize, de Morenschildt's death, as the HSCA was trying to contact him, was Bill O'Reilly. And O'Reilly had left a message for Gayton Fonzie on his machine saying, Gayton, you know what happened down there? You know, we got to get down to Florida. And, you know, then he didn't know that tape existed. And then he was an ear witness in the inquest, which Mark Lane was at. And O'Reilly was saying he heard the shot from the house and no one left, so it had to be suicide. And then he hadn't even been in Florida. But I just thought de Morenschildt in general is such a strange character. Would you like to talk a little bit about him?
Well, yeah, I heard a bit about the Bill O'Reilly story. From what I heard, maybe that it was debunked that he could have actually heard the shot, but I don't really remember.
Well, he wouldn't have been in the state. He left a message, you know, that was recorded, and then Gayton Fonzie's widow released it. So he was admitting on the tape what happened, and then he went from what happened, I got to get down there, to he was on the stoop, which couldn't possibly have happened. So it's just an interesting aside about Bill O'Reilly and the veracity of the news media. I don't know how he gets away without answering that and other questions. But in general, just about George de Morenschildt, he's a very mysterious character, very strange ties. He comes in, you know, and all these people, if Oswald is this crazy person trying to make a name for himself, it's very odd that the white Russians and the far right are embracing him. So what do you think about George de Morenschildt?
Yeah, George de Morenschildt has always been one of the most fascinating characters to me. it's you know, it's like one of those things you're not going to hear much about, you know, if you just get the sort of gloss over version of the JFK assassination story. So he was basically Oswald's best friend in Dallas, and he's this CIA connected, sort of aristocratic white Russian, vehemently anti-communist. And you know, from the document I saw, the CIA actually called him an unpaid informant. So it's pretty much verified that he was doing work for them. He was, you know, he was debriefed, and he was on friendly terms with the head CIA guy in Dallas, J. Walton Moore. So yeah, it makes you wonder what the hell is Oswald, who's supposed to be kind of a loner communist, you know, poor kid, what's he doing hanging out with George de Morenschild? It doesn't add up. And then the fact that de Morenschild either kills himself or is murdered on the same day that the HSCA is trying to set up an interview with him, they came to come to his house, is pretty suspicious. So it's one of those things where, yeah, people deserve to know about this. And you know, maybe it's more complicated than we've been told.
Well, that was an excellent answer, and I cede my time to the senator from Wisconsin.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the film makes a very strong suggestion, and I believe it's true, that George de Morenschild was the CIA handler for the Oswalds, and handed them over to Ruth and Michael Payne. And de Morenschild left for Haiti, which is suspicious also, that he was apparently doing some other job for the CIA, went to Haiti and was not in Dallas when the assassination occurred. But the Paynes met Oswald and de Morenschild at a party, and Ruth talks about that in your film. It was a lot of oil people who were, you know, people who worked for an oil company were at this party, and it seems to have been a case, you know, a way of introducing all of them. And it all kind of ties together. And in the film, you get Ruth to admit on camera that her sister was CIA and her father had some connections. He was working for the AID, which is an agency of the U.S. government that has ties to the CIA. And you show documentation about the sister and the father's connections. But then Ruth, she's very clever. She's 89 years old now, but sharp as a tack. And she seems to be a very well-trained operative. She tells the same story over and over again. There's a remarkable montage in the film of her telling a basic story about Oswald, and then you cut from decade to decade where she's kind of saying the same words or following the same train of thought. She's very disciplined, so it's really hard to get her to veer from that. But she has trouble answering a few questions, I noticed, and that's indicative. I thought one question that she seemed to struggle with was when you asked her about their finances. You say that you and Michael lived modestly in Dallas, but didn't Michael have a trust fund with the Forbes family? And she kind of really had trouble answering that, didn't she, Max?
Yeah, she didn't seem to want to answer that directly, that she didn't just say, yes, he had a trust fund. She kind of had a roundabout answer. It is odd that the Paynes were wealthy, educated liberals, and they're living in this working class suburb of Dallas, Irving, in a tiny house. And it just didn't, you know, it seems strange, like they wouldn't fit in there. But you know, I think from what I've seen, I think they've lived fairly modestly, you know, their whole lives. Besides going to vacation on this private island and, So the Ruth uses this term noblesse oblige to describe the attitude of the Forbes family, and you know, that's it means, you know, people who are born with the advantage of the nobility or wealth, like, have a duty to serve the society. And so I think that's kind of how they saw themselves, and they were living modestly. Still, it's yeah, it does seem a little strange.
She kind of fumbles and stumbles over that one. And another moment I noticed is when you ask her point blank, have you ever been involved with the FBI or the CIA? And there's a long pause, isn't there? That's quite interesting, before she answers. I wonder what you make of that.
Yeah, I noticed that pause again last night when I saw the film. And yeah, these are things that people can take them either way. It depends what you think. You know, with Ruth telling the same story over the years, you can say, oh, well, she just got so used to telling the same story that it comes out the same way. People who are interviewed over and over again about the same event often do that. Or you can see it as suspicious that she's, you know, kind of sticking to a set story, and she's got the certain points she's hitting. That story she tells of the police coming in and looking for the rifle, and there's this moment when the policeman lifts up the blanket where the rifle was supposed to be stored, and that's the moment when she says, it could have been Lee. And she's, you know, she's said that in so many interviews over the years. It's like her trademark line. If you see her in these specials over the, you know, last six decades, she gives that line a lot, and they like to use it.
She also seems to, I mean, if you want to be skeptical about her, she seems to tear up at exactly the same moment, like a practice kind of routine. When she talks about that, that's where she kind of starts to break down or dab her eyes. And that's why it's hard to crack a person like that. And you don't press her too hard, but you do press her as much as can be done. I mean, I suppose there was a did you have in your mind that if you were too tough with her on certain things, she might just walk away and that'd be the end of your filming? Were you trying to avoid that?
Yeah, I was, and I sort of left the most uncomfortable questions to the end of the last interview, that I felt at after that I probably wouldn't get to film with her anymore, because she would, you know, wouldn't like where the questioning was going. Yeah, she never got too flustered or angry or anything. She's very strong. She listened to those questions. She answered them. And at the end of that interview, I told her, like, thanks for putting up with this. I appreciate it. And, you know, that I didn't think I would be doing my job as like a documentarian or journalist if I didn't ask those questions. Yeah. So she understood that. Yeah, even ever since then, whenever I've seen her, talk to her, she's nice. At a certain point, she did say that she didn't want to be involved with the project anymore. And so since then, I've left her alone. I didn't send her the finished copy of the film. And, she turns 90 this year. I don't want to harass her, make her angry. And you know, I have a lot of empathy and respect for Ruth. Whatever you see her as, like, completely guilty or totally innocent, I think you still have to maintain some empathy for her as a person, who's been through something very difficult, you know, and been put in this position with people, you know, the spotlight on her and people are accusing her and the pressure of this, you know, being tied to this event for the rest of history. I think, it's important to air all these questions, not to just ignore them because they're uncomfortable or it would be disrespectful to Ruth, which is kind of something people have been accusing me of, just a few, you know, very small handful of people, who've been attacking the film. You know, they say this is, you know, conspiracy mongering, this is rumors, and you made this stuff up. There's not a shred of evidence, and this is disgraceful abuse of an elderly person, stuff like that. You know, that's okay. People can have that opinion. I set out to make something provocative. I knew it was going to offend some people, but I thought it was the right thing to do. And, you know, 95% of the people who've seen it, seem to agree.
Yeah. You've had some wonderful responses, and it's also, penetrated in a way that a lot of documentaries don't. It's on numerous, screening sites, streaming sites. Could you tell the listeners where they could watch it, actually, before we move on?
Yeah, so people can find the movie. It's called The Assassination and Mrs. Payne, on Amazon, on iTunes, on Google Play, on Vimeo, YouTube Movies. It's not available on DVD yet, maybe sometime in the future. And my website is jfkpayne.com, and that's also my handle on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah, it's remarkable for a low-budget documentary. I mean, it looks very highly professional and beautifully done. And but you've had, as you say, mostly positive response, but I noticed there's a site called the JFK Assassination, the Education Forum. They have a JFK assassination section, and some of the lone nut people, as we call them, the people who think Oswald did it alone, have been having sort of a systematic attack on the film, which is somewhat subsided a little bit, but they're hammering away at Oswald's guilt, and they also reopened the Tippit case, which I think shows that both you and I struck nerves on our respective subjects. You know, when JFK came out, the Oliver Stone film, it had a barrage of negative attacks, but it did very well at the box office, and a lot of reviewers praised it. But it's a sign of the film striking a nerve that some people feel the need to attack it, and they've had blog articles criticizing certain things in it. But you also told me Bert Griffin, who was one of the Warren Commission staff members, wrote you an email, didn't he? What was that about? What was he telling you?
Yeah, Bert Griffin is one of the few surviving people who was a staff attorney for the Warren Commission, and he's been defending the Warren Commission since they released their report, and he's been very vocal. He, you know, thinks that they got it completely right, and he says there isn't a single piece of evidence pointing towards conspiracy. He somehow got wind of my film, and I was in Dallas in 2019, and he was going to be there, and I tried to get an interview with him just at an event. Actually, Ruth was speaking at some public library there, and I just, you know, pulled him aside and tried to get an interview with him, and he did the interview. It was fine, and then he asked like what it was for, who I was, and when he heard, he kind of exploded on me and told me you know, what a disgrace it was that I was doing this film and I'm, you know, slandering Ruth Payne and that I should be ashamed of myself. And he said, you can't use this footage. So, yeah, he had something against the project. And then after it was released, he sent me an email and CC'd Ruth, and he, sort of threatened me saying that I should, you know, withdraw the film and that it was, some sort of travesty and, you know, offensive to Ruth, and was just making stuff up and there was nothing to it. So Ruth never responded to that as far as I know. But yeah, this I think the Paynes, this is some reason this topic pisses some people off. Maybe because they see the Paynes as being ultimately innocent, who they were just, you know, just bystanders to this whole thing, and to try to tie them into it is some sort of disgrace. Or you could say maybe the Paynes strike a nerve and their family CIA connections, you know, start to go in directions that these people don't want anybody to consider.
Yeah, she's been written about a lot there. As you point out in the film, there were about 5,000 or 6,000 questions asked her by the Warren Commission, and it's not like she's of shrinking violence. She's a public figure. That's one reason I think Bert Griffin's warnings have no merit, because if you're a public figure like she is, and she's making it possible, she's giving interviews to a lot of people, including you, and she willingly did the film, and she's mentally sharp. And so if you're in that category, you're fair game, and she's a historical figure. And so he also says to you that several times, I don't know what journalistic ethics are. I mean, he admits that, and you certainly don't violate those, but for him to be warning you, I would think it's not worth bothering with, but it is a sign of something. I guess it brings more public attention. Movies, that's one reason JFK got so much heat. A movie is seen by more people probably than most books about the assassination, and how many people, as Alan Dulles cynically put it about when they published the 26 volumes of evidence and hearings in the Warren Report, he said, nobody will read this. He said, there'll be a few professors who read this, but nobody reads in America. And it's not actually true. I mean, a lot of people have read it, but more tending to be specialists. So here you have a film which is entertaining, and you get to see her and her where she lives. And it does have more impact, perhaps. But I think that, you know, you're exposing things that make them uncomfortable. And you know, Ruth Payne, I think part of her, I mean, it's clear that she likes the attention to some extent. She may feel victimized, but she's also kind of thrives on the attention in her retirement home and throughout her life. There were periods where she didn't really materialize much. She worked as a school teacher and a psychologist and a principal, and then she went to Nicaragua. We can talk about that. That's a fascinating part of her saga that you go into, but you know, she's hasn't been, I mean, there's never been a film like this about her. She's been interviewed a lot. And I was at an event she did in Santa Rosa, where she lives. It was a women's club event in 2013, and C-SPAN came and taped it, and you could see it on YouTube. And Clint Hill, the agent who was Jacqueline Kennedy's agent in the motorcade, he's the guy who jumped out of the follow-up car and jumped on top of the limousine and protected Mrs. Kennedy and rode on the car to Parkland Hospital. He's an important figure, but he gives a lot of interviews too. And he was at the C-SPAN event. And at one thing at that event, we weren't allowed to question her directly by putting our hands up, which I found frustrating. I had several questions prepared, and Jim DiEugenio, who's a JFK expert, who wrote the Oliver Stone documentary, we should mention, JFK Revisited, is getting a lot of attention too, and that's available in streaming. And he helped me craft a couple questions to her, But they made us put the questions in a little box, and this woman who was sitting at the dais, one of the club people, screened the questions, and she'd pull them out and then ask her certain questions. And I had two in there, and one she didn't ask Mrs. Payne. The other one, Mrs. Payne, her eyebrows raised when I asked this one. It was, how come pieces of evidence kept emerging from your garage days and weeks after the police and the sheriff's department thoroughly searched it? And she understood immediately the import of the question, and her answer was kind of disingenuous. She said she thought they didn't do a good job searching her home, which is kind of not a very good answer. But she found the Walker letter that you mentioned, which was a note from Oswald supposedly to his wife about what to do if he was arrested. And she said she found that in a book that belonged to Marina, and she found it a few days after the assassination and shook out the book, and this letter popped out. And the remarkable thing was the Secret Service, she gave it to them, and they brought it back to her and suggested that she may have drafted the note. She may have written it. She copied Oswald's draft, and they wondered if she had written it. And they also told Marina that stay away from Ruth because she's connected with the CIA. And you bring up these points with her, and she gets uncomfortable about those. And she said, I noticed that she said she cut off connections with Marina, but that wasn't actually the case. Marina cut off connections with her. You know, if you're up on the case, she was very, very upset and emotional about Marina not wanting to talk to her anymore. But Marina was sort of under house arrest, in effect, for a few months, where the government was making her blame her husband. And it is remarkable that most of what Oswald called the so-called evidence, he told his brother Robert on the November 23rd, don't believe all this so-called evidence. So that's what I always call it. And most of it came from the Payne house and from Mrs. Payne and Marina, who both testified that Oswald was guilty. And without that, they wouldn't have any case at all, because they didn't have a credible witness who saw him shooting or anything like that. And one thing I'd like to ask you, when you say the rifle was transported from New Orleans, John Armstrong wrote a fantastic book called Harvey and Lee, which was the result of long research. And in my opinion, he basically proved that Oswald did not own the rifle or the pistol that were entered into evidence. And so the rifle was planted, it appears, and it was identified at first as a Mauser, and then they changed the story and said it was a Mannlicher Carcano. So do you really think that the rifle was in Mrs. Payne's station wagon and her garage, or what?
I don't know. I think that's speculation for everyone. Nobody, Marina didn't know. Ruth didn't know. You know, Oswald supposedly would be the only person who could say if the rifle was packed into that station wagon and brought back from New Orleans. I have no idea. I don't really have an yeah. opinion on it. The story of the Mauser is very intriguing. I've read about that. And I don't know all the details with the, you know, the mail order rifle and whether it actually existed. Also, Ruth was acting as an interpreter for Marina when the police came. So some people, you know, see that as suspicious as whatever, you know, Marina was saying. Ruth had, you know, some power over that. But the, you know, the story that she tells is that the police asked if there was a rifle, if Oswald had a rifle. Ruth said no, because I guess she thought he didn't have one. And Marina said yes, and said it's in the garage. So they went to the garage and looked in this blanket where it was supposed to be, and it wasn't there. Some of these things I just acknowledge I don't know enough to say exactly what I think the truth is.
Yeah, it's hard
I haven't studied it enough. Yeah.
to. In a documentary, you don't have a lot of time to go into everything, and you leave it in Ruth's words, and then people who are interested can read more about it. But Armstrong, basically, you look at the documents, there's a whole paper trail that the Warren Commission claimed to prove that he owned these guns, and Armstrong demolishes that quite convincingly, I believe, and there is no credible evidence that he picked up the rifle or that he owned it. And for example, that blanket has had no oil that it would have had if a gun was in there. But that's another of the important side issues. But Ruth always acts like she was very upset to find that there was a gun in her home because she's a Quaker and doesn't believe in violence, and that was one of her big sources of anger. And I'll mention one thing I discovered in my research for Into the Nightmare. One of the first important pieces on Ruth Payne that helped establish her role as a kindly Quaker do-gooder was written by Jessamine West, who was the Quaker woman who wrote the book The Friendly Persuasion, which was made into a movie called Friendly Persuasion with Gary Cooper, about a Quaker family during the Civil War. And it's about whether, what does a pacifist do during wartime, et cetera, a famous film. And she was a cousin of Richard Nixon, and she wrote one of the first big pieces on Mrs. Payne in McCall's magazine. I'm sorry, in Redbook magazine, which was owned by the McCall Corporation. And that was in '64. And it turns out that I checked who owned the McCall Corporation. It turned out that Marvin Pierce was the president, and he was the father of Barbara Pierce Bush, the wife of George H.W. Bush, who had some connections of his own to the assassination and was a CIA guy. So it appears that they planted that propaganda to establish Ruth as a Quaker do-gooder. And but even Jessamine West says at one point Ruth Payne told her she was glad that Oswald was killed, and Jessamine West said that's a very un-Quakerish comment that is appalling, and even she disassociated herself from that. And Ruth didn't quite say that in your film, but she says in your film that when Oswald was shot, she thought, well, at least Marina doesn't have to be going through the ordeal of a trial, which is kind of callous. And she also, and you go into this, she's been accused of not helping Oswald get an attorney, and she says she got a phone call from Oswald from jail on the Saturday, and he asked her to call an attorney. And the story is that the man's name was John Abt, ABT. He was a guy who had represented some communists in the past, a prominent left-wing lawyer. And in my view, he was shamefully ducking his responsibility. He was in the country in New York and was dodging the phone calls. I mean, I knew watching TV that he was trying to reach John Abt, and John Abt didn't know about it, he claimed, but he failed to represent Oswald, so Oswald had no attorney. But Ruth said on other occasions that she was angry that Oswald would presume to ask her for help getting an attorney, which is, again, Ruth was a member of the ACLU, and I think she says something in your film that there is a right to an attorney and he should have had one. But she didn't really act like that at the time, and an ACLU officer came to see Oswald at the jail, and a member of the Dallas Bar Association, because Oswald, this was alarming, the night of the assassination when he gave his press conference, said, I've been denied or haven't had legal representation. I call on somebody to give me legal representation. And this caused a lot of concern around the country among lawyers and law school professors, et cetera. And so the Bar Association and ACLU tried to contact him, and Oswald said he wanted John Abt because he didn't trust Dallas lawyers, probably for good reason. So unfortunately, he died before he had an attorney. And if he had an attorney, a lot would be different. But so she didn't seem to be helpful to him, even though she was an ACLU member. What do you think of all that?
Yeah, that's curious. Her attitude when he was killed does seem callous and might bring into question, you know, the kind of saintly characterization a lot of people have of her. Yeah, the lawyer story, I wasn't aware that that was publicized over the media as well.
There's a TV interview, TV interview with the guy from the Bar Association who had just come from the cell, and he, I saw it again recently. He was saying, well, Oswald, we offered him help and he didn't want help and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, it does seem like Ruth didn't try that hard, and she was resentful that he was asking anything of her. You'd think maybe she'd give him the benefit of the doubt, but I guess at that point she'd have decided that he was guilty, and you know she didn't want to help him.
And she acted personally offended that he would be abusing her hospitality and storing a weapon in her home and all that kind of thing. That's her story, anyway.
Yeah.
In the midst of that stuff, did Marina Oswald ever comment on whether she did offer to go and find the rifle? Like, it seems kind of strange that she would have had no indications of his behavior being erratic if that was the case. And she just ran and got them, you know, this blanket. Like, that story, just something about it doesn't seem to ring true too easily.
Yeah.
Well, she admitted that she told the police, yeah, there was a rifle here, but the policeman, as Max demonstrates in the film, picked up the blanket and it was limp. But Ruth, that's when Ruth supposedly knew that there was a rifle in the house. But Marina was the source of that as well. And one thing about Marina, the wife of an accused person can't testify against him in court, so some of that evidence might have been thrown out, so-called evidence.
Yeah, also a couple of details about the blanket, that Michael Payne actually handled the blanket, and he said that he thought there was camping equipment in there. That was his story. This was, you know, before the assassination. He was in the garage and touched the blanket, I guess. It's strange that the blanket is just sitting there on the floor of the garage. That's if somebody was trying to hide a gun, it didn't seem like a great place. Also, a detail that Ruth leaves out when she tells the story is that she testified that she, when they went in to the garage with the police and Marina, she stepped on the blanket, you know, I guess to see if there was anything in it. I never heard her say that again. Just
one thing you do is very good thing in the film when she makes a statement that is erroneous or dubious, you often cut to some expert like Jim DiEugenio or Bill Simpich to tell the real story, to clarify the facts, like talking about the Walker note and how implausible that was. I mean, for example, that there's one eyewitness to the Walker shooting who was a teenage boy, and he said two men departed the scene, and neither one looked like Oswald, and they also were never able to connect the so-called rifle with the ballistics in the Walker case, and you clarify those things. One thing I was curious about this fellow, you could tell this story, which is very important in your film, about the Paynes had these metal file cabinets, which were established by police documents. The police found metal file cabinets in their home and took them out as evidence, and they supposedly contained records of surveillance by Michael, at least, on left-wing groups in Dallas. He apparently was spying on them, and Oswald went with him on certain occasions. Oswald, you know, masqueraded as a communist, but he wasn't a communist. And he, in my view, he worked for the FBI. He was an FBI informant. And I found out that he met with the FBI at least three times in November of 63 before the assassination, which is more than most people know. Henry Wade, the DA, told me Oswald met with the FBI the day before the assassination, which is was news. And I said, the day before? And he said, well, a day or two before, which is remarkable. So, but in the film, you show actually one of these metal file cabinets that was supposedly a Warren Commission exhibit. And then in the report, it leaves blank what was supposedly in these containers. And Ruth kind of makes light of it. But how did that man, he's a friend of Ruth's, he says, and he's a researcher. He seems to support her, but and he had a background with the U.S. government and intelligence. How did he get that metal container, and do you believe that it really was a legitimate container that the Warren Commission saw, or what's the story about that?
Yeah, so that man's name is Joe Alisi, and he contacted me while I was making the film. He heard about it, and you know, seemed supportive, and he you know, just was interested, and he told me he had become friends with Ruth, and he even got some of this memorabilia from her.
He got the container from Ruth directly, or did he get it on eBay?
That's the story. He got the file cabinet directly from Ruth.
How did she get it back after the police took it? And,
they gave those back to her.
Okay.
I guess because those were Warren Commission exhibits that weren't used for whatever reason, even though they got numbers. They were Warren Commission 457 and 458, I believe, and they're listed in the Warren report, but it just says these numbers were not used. But
right.
Yes, I believe that is actually one of the file cabinets. I think that's you know, true from what I've heard other places, that they were these small sized file cabinets.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so this guy Joe Alisi is interesting. He reached out to me, and I interviewed him, and you know, he just pulls out this little placard from the Defense Investigative Service, and he told me that he used to work for the government for many years, and he was in background checks. His job was performing background checks on people for security clearances. So, you know, some people, it might be a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
Other people don't seem to be, bothered by it at all. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, he became a good friend of Ruth. He gets her to sign lots of things. He's got lots of pictures of Ruth and her family, and he hangs out with her. He was also hanging out with Michael Payne, and he even bought this drill press from Michael Payne that Oswald used to like drill a hole through a Mexican peso or something to make a necklace for Marina. He's got this huge thing in his garage, and he's got a lot of he's like a, you know, assassination buff collector. He's got a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Interesting guy. He says that he thinks there probably was a conspiracy, but he thinks the Paynes are completely innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also been one of these people attacking my film online. I've seen some posts on Facebook or something where he's, you know, saying this movie's a disgrace and everybody should be against it. But
do you have any
specific
comments? Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, he was very friendly, and glad he participated in the film. Yeah.
Do you have any specific comments to make about the people who've picked over certain details in the film, criticizing the film? Is there anything that particularly you'd like to talk about, or are they just blowing hot air?
Well, a couple more things about this guy, Joe Alisi. He flew with Ruth to Dallas in 2019. He escorted her to Dallas and was, escorting her to these different interviews and stuff she was doing. And what I saw online, he's probably going to do that again in 2023. He's going to be, her escort to Dallas. There are these people who, most of them are on the official story side. Some of them are not. There's all these gradations in, whether you think, there was a coup conspiracy or it was just a mob thing or whatever. But, I haven't seen anything that has debunked anything of significance in my film in a clear way. They may be able to throw some doubt on something small, but I stand by the film and think it's factual. If anything major comes out that is proven wrong, I will acknowledge that. But I think a lot of these people are not being honest, and they are, just trying to cast doubt, because they don't like, people exploring this and asking questions. They'd rather to shut down any debate.
But in the midst of that, if I can jump in, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but the conversations Johnson, LBJ had with Hoover and Oswald going over to Mexico, and basically of Earl Warren being, berated into taking the role that he took, and he left in tears, and Johnson saying 40 million people can die. I mean, that's really the case. I mean, you shouldn't have to defend yourself on ancillary issues that are important. You did a very good job with it. But those are recorded, documented conversations. It was interesting that you said the one we have a transcript because someone erased the conversation. I thought your section on Mexico City was mind-blowing. I knew of Mexico City, and I always thought it was important. I didn't know as much about the letter that linked Oswald to Kostikov, that it was another piece of evidence Ruth Payne just happened to find. I thought that was dynamite. So really, these people who are coming after you, it's interesting that all are at least somewhat linked to the government or used to work for the government. Is this gentleman, the last gentleman you were talking about, DeMarchio, Ruth Payne, everybody around Oswald, and then even back in New Orleans, he's surrounded by ultra-right-wing people and people who have some connection to the agency. But could you talk a little bit more about that letter? Because I thought you did a great job with it, but it's kind of getting lost in the shuffle. I thought that Mexico City letter that she coughed up, and then you said the Secret Service brought it back and gave it to her, and they seemed to think that she typed it. I thought that was a dynamite piece of evidence.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you for noticing that. I think the Costin letter, as it's called, is maybe my most important piece, tied to Ruth specifically. And so this was a letter that Oswald allegedly wrote to the Soviet embassy in D.C. Just a couple weeks before the assassination, and he asked to borrow Ruth Payne's typewriter while he was staying at her house to write the letter. Ruth says that he had a rough draft, handwritten rough draft, and he was typing it from that, and he kind of tried to hide what he was writing when she walked by. And then later he left this copy, this handwritten copy sitting on the desk, and she decided to basically steal it from him, and, you know, read it. And she decided that, this letter, was, you know, was suspicious enough that she was going to give it to the FBI the next time they came out. So that the FBI had been to her house in October a couple times and spoke to her about Oswald. So she already kind of had a relationship, with the FBI agent. So yeah, a lot of people, this is very strange. Her story is a little weird.
But if someone did give her that letter, like, forgive me for jumping in, but I thought it was so important. If someone did give her the task to write that letter, she would have had to have been apprised of the events that happened in Mexico City. So most people who listen in to Joe and listen to you and, you know, listen to the Kennedy shows are going to know in Mexico City that it was probably an imposter who was going to the embassies to make Oswald look quite virulent. And going over and putting on a dog and pony show. And even the photograph they had of Oswald was not him entering the embassy. There was a tape that, you know, they had said was destroyed, but it still existed. Hoover's telling Johnson it wasn't Oswald that was there. But, I mean, that's the damning thing. Then you have that is the really the key to the cover-up, because then Johnson can go up to everyone, even such as high up as Earl Warren, and say, we have to cover this up or 40 million people could die if Oswald is linked to meeting Valerie Costacava, who is supposedly the head of assassinations in the Western Hemisphere. So this is dynamite. So Ruth, if this letter was constructed by her, someone had to be running her. We can draw that conclusion because she wouldn't have this information. And it's very damning information and such. But that, you know, in every move she's making, for such as Joe was saying before, it just made me want to scream. Like, he's calling up asking her to get him a lawyer. All of a sudden, she knows he's guilty. Like, she just feels this, like the gun, there was an empty blanket. So she, this person who lives her life trying to help people and trying to, you know, further the good of mankind, and she's so interested in people's rights. She calls, the guy doesn't answer his phone, John Apt, so she doesn't go, like, what would a normal person do? You would beat the bushes trying to get some lawyer to get down there. He was even on the news saying, I request legal representation. So I've jumped around quite a bit, but don't you think someone would have had to tell Ruth Payne, who was in the know, you know, that Mexico City write this letter, that that was like the hot potato. I mean, 40 million people could die. I think to defend yourself and shut all these Posners down and all these other people is, what was Johnson talking to about Hoover? Those other questions you handled quite well, and they're going to pick you, you know, pick apart anyone who states the evidence as such. But it really makes me irate, because I think the answer is right there in the conversations with Hoover, LBJ, and Earl Warren. Am I wrong?
You're right. And I'd like to see people try to debunk those recorded conversations or those transcripts, but they can't. They can't. And if they want to say there's nothing suspicious to it, that's fine. They can say that, but a reasonable person will not agree when we have a transcript of Hoover talking to Johnson saying that Oswald was, you know, there was an imposter pretending to be Oswald in Mexico City.
Yeah, that in and of itself is huge. There's an imposter. Joe was just talking about Armstrong and two Oswalds. I mean, there's an imposter in Mexico City who would be impersonating this guy who they keep telling us is nobody, who'd been over as, you know, a radar operator at Atsugi with a clearance, and then he's probably in a false defector program. Who would be impersonating Oswald anyway at this point? That in and of itself is huge, no?
Yeah, it is.
I thought that was so important, and you did such a good job in the film. It was worth, many things in the film are worth the price of admission, but this alone, I thought was. I just thought that was mind-blowing, and you did a great job with it.
Thank you. Yeah, I think Mexico City is key. And you saw when some of the documents were declassified around 2017, stories in the mainstream media about the assassination. And one that always pops up again is the communist conspiracy. And, oh, Oswald went to Mexico City and went to the Soviet embassy. Was he conspiring with the communists? You don't hear about this conversation between Hoover and LBJ, or the photos of that were supposedly Oswald that obviously aren't. If you're watching mainstream media, those are things you have to go, search out on shows like this, or books like Joe's. So yeah, I've never heard a plausible explanation for why that wouldn't be suspicious and wouldn't, throw doubt on Oswald being in Mexico City. Ruth is central in this whole story. She's central to the Walker note, to the Walker shooting. She's central to the Costin letter, and these are the two extremely important pieces of evidence. People can speculate if Ruth forged this letter herself, or somebody gave her a copy, to turn in and say that Oswald wrote it. There's no evidence we have of that. We have Ruth's story. We have the letters. Oswald allegedly sent it, and it was intercepted and copied before it was sent on to the Soviet embassy. An interesting little point in the movie is that the Soviets thought that letter was a provocation, and that the authorities had forged it or told Oswald to write it as a way to sort of establish to make it look like Oswald was connected to the Russians. That was their official position on it.
And then to clarify the point for the listener, like at that point in time, if they had squashed Oswald being impersonated in Mexico City, then good men could have participated, such as Earl Warren, in the cover-up, because you have Johnson telling him 40 million people could die. So then people say, well, how do you get all these people to go along with, covering this up? Well, because you're telling, you're putting a national security out there, and you're even going to the, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and shutting him down. So how could on their feet, FBI agents or any other agents, police, you can't stand up to that kind of power. But it makes me wonder, as this letter is coming to fruition now, she has it and hands it out. If this leaks, it just makes me wonder if the plotters were, wanted an invasion and something to happen, and it didn't happen. It was being squashed. And now this letter, if it ever got loose earlier, it could have brought into question, did Russia have something to do with it, and ended us up right back in another Cuban Missile Crisis. Is that plausible?
Yeah, I think researchers like Peter Dale Scott say that they think there were people who actually wanted to provoke a war. They weren't just planting this evidence to use as some backstop to the investigation of a possible conspiracy, and that how it turned out was determined on the fly as things were happening. This is like complex dynamics that you know, average people probably haven't heard of, that there could be this, you know, this communist conspiracy. The evidence for it was manufactured, and that was used as a way to get people to participate in a cover-up.
Which is just one reason your film is important in and of it. That piece alone was so important, and you bring up so much other information. I had wondered if she was benign in a sense that the assassination occurred and she didn't know it was going to happen. But even if they had put pressure on her after it happened, she's been complicit all these years and she's had no remorse. Like, in other words, you know, she seems also to have had more interest in Marina Oswalt than she did in Lee Harvey Oswalt. And that would sort of fit if she was looking into left people and they knew that Oswald was a fake defector. It seemed more like she knew, you know, Marina possibly could have been an agent being sent back with him by the way she got into the country. But her close relationship with Marina is very interesting. Like, you know, just on face value, like, why was the obsession there with her? Her thing about, well, I was lonely and I needed someone to talk to. So you picked a communist. I mean, they're hanging out with white Russians. It just, I wanted to bone up on my Russian, so to speak. And, you know, I've heard things said where someone said they have in their possession letters and they almost seem like love letters between Mrs. Payne and Marina. So I haven't seen them. So I just say allegedly, but do you have anything to say about the relationship, like, any further on Marina and Mrs. Payne?
Yeah, I didn't read all the letters between them, and I heard some rumors that people have espoused about there being some lesbian relationship or some, you know, something like that between Ruth and Marina. I just thought
that did the Quaker go to that? I joke.
What was that?
It's just a little joke. I said, did the Quakers, you know, order that? Is that the normal business? You have someone come over from communist Russia and they enter into an alleged lesbian affair. I mean, and she's painting herself as a humanitarian trying to help these people. And then she buries Oswald. It's just as I go through the sequence of events in your film and the way Mrs. Payne talks, she's so naive. She's so naive. She comes across to me as not naive at all.
Yeah, so I didn't see the evidence of the lesbian relationship, and I also thought, oh, that's just, it's too sensationalistic. I'm not going to go there. And I've noticed, you know, some of these people trying to attack, you know, they tried to attack my film, even though that's not in my film, because other people have mentioned it, that there's, you know, oh, this is, they're just being homophobic or something by bringing this up. So I know nothing about that.
Another specious defense, right? That's just, you know, it's another specious defense or attack, like it, that they're pulling out of their hat. Like they do the same thing with Clay Shaw and David Ferry. It's just a fact that those guys were, you know, into that. I think Garrison went out of his way, not to stray too far from our topic, but he went out of his way not to bring that up and use that in the defense. But Clay Shaw was, you know, that was a theme of the case. So, and it had nothing to do with your documentary, but I think you did a good job. But on that note, I'm going to cede my time again to the esteemed senator from Wisconsin, yeah, Joseph McBride.
Thank you. Well, I have a bunch of other questions. Max, Bob brought up the question of, you know, this is purely speculative at this point, but was she fully witting of the conspiracy to kill the president, or was she just used in the preliminary aspects, and she didn't know why they were telling her to help Oswald get the job at the school book depository, etc. That could have been the case. And it, often in plots like that, there's compartmentalization that it's wise not to tell everybody, you know, what's going to happen. But as has been said here, she's continued to maintain the cover story and help buttress it by finding evidence, et cetera, and giving her testimony, et cetera. But do you think it's possible that she was just a part of something and then she didn't realize Kennedy would be shot? If that were true, she would be very shocked dismayed. I don't know how you would. I don't know at this point if there's any way to find that out. And I think I have the impression from your film that you got about as much out of her as anybody could. I don't know how much more she could be persuaded to say, but you never know. But what's your thought about all that?
Yeah, well, I don't want to speculate about, you know, what Ruth's guilt or innocence, but other people who I interviewed and talked to, the vast majority, you know, maybe all of them who think that she's hiding something, do not think that she knew about the assassination beforehand. They think that she would have been given some isolated role, and, you know, the extent of that is also speculation. You can say, you know, people might think that she forged this note, or, you know, found evidence, and, or people might think that, that stuff was placed there and she just happened to find it. And, you know, she did what she thought was right or something. You know, some people think it could be as minor as somebody, you know, somebody from her family giving her a suggestion to befriend the Oswalds. You know, you can speculate how much that makes sense to you, of what level of guilt. I'm not personally going to go there.
I was a little surprised. In the film, Bill Simpich, researcher, says flatly, he says, "I don't know anybody who has claimed that she was witting of the assassination," but there are people who claim that, actually, aren't there?
I haven't come across those people, but I've heard, I think, from you that they're out there. And maybe I've seen comments online just from, you know, random people on YouTube saying that.
You actually have Vincent Salandria, one of the early researchers, who basically says as much. I mean, he says they're agents and they're up to their eyes in the assassination, and I think that's his implication. And there's a book there are two books collecting his articles and letters and things, and he's quite strong on the Paines being fully witting of things. But
really,
from what
he told me, I thought that he thought they were, even in the film, he said something about them being given very little information. That was his position, that he didn't think they would have known about the assassination plot, that they would have been given some smaller role to play.
Yeah, I think in the book of letters, there's a lot of debate between him and especially one other person. I mean, they're raising the possibility and discussing it, at least. I mean, because nobody can know for sure. But it has been thrown into the mix. But, you know, she's another thing. You know, one thing when you mentioned that the viewer should think for himself, John Ford, again, I'll mention him because he's my favorite director, but he would never tell the media what he thought the point of one of his films was, or almost never. And I interviewed him, and it was kind of maddening because he would not give me those kind of answers. And then I realized I really respected that, because he wants people to think for themselves about the complex plots of his films and themes. And then Stanley Kubrick told Steven Spielberg once, never tell the press what your intent was about a film, because that's all they will say. They'll keep repeating that, as if, you know, there's a kind of an agreement in film studies that the author of the film, his point of view is important, but what's really important is the film. And so, but a lot of people just quote the director and say, this is what the film is about. So I think you do that. I think you leave it up to the audience. And I think that's highly, it's an excellent idea. And in this case, it's very good because it shows your, openness to different points of view, but you let us make up our own minds. Although I think you make some strong hints occasionally that you believe certain things are suspicious. But was that your strategy from the beginning when you made this film?
Yeah, I think from the very beginning, I wanted it to have both sides and to kind of respect Ruth's version of things, like give her a chance to tell her story, and then we would have also the people who are giving the counterpoint, and it's up to people to decide who they believe. And you know, usually people who see the film are appreciative of that, and a lot of times they, I will get the question, you know, what do you really think? What is she guilty, or do you think there was a conspiracy? And, you know, my position is just to say, I'm not going to answer those questions because I want the film to speak for itself. And I want people to see it who are on both sides. I don't want people to go in thinking, oh, this is coming from that perspective, so it must be propaganda, or, you know, I don't agree with that conclusion, so everything in this film must be bullshit, you know? That's not productive. People can, you know, come to whatever conclusion they want about what my perspective is, you know, from what's in the film and, you know, what I'm saying, but I'm still gonna maintain, you know, that I'm not gonna give you an easy answer to that, because I really do want people to think for themselves. I don't want to make a piece of propaganda either way. I don't want to make a piece of propaganda in service of my position either. I want people to be watching critically.
It makes me think of Errol Morris's documentaries, which are brilliant. He presents strong points of view, but he doesn't spell it out for the audience. I notice a couple times in your film there are some very suggestive moments. At one point you talk about how Ruth kept miraculously, as you put it, finding evidence in her garage. That's rather suggestive. And also the image, you do some things visually, like you have that summer trip you talk about, illustrated with a map of the U.S. with an animated little station wagon driving to the island, and then to Philadelphia, and then to the D.C. area, and then down to pick up Marina and off to Dallas. And that image is pretty strong. It literally shows connections, but you don't spell it out. You let people kind of draw their own conclusions. But I think there's some, maybe this is the kind of thing that rankles the believers in the single bullet theory, that not only do you raise these issues, but you show the suspicions. But again, you're not saying this is, you know, this proves that she was an asset and she was given her instructions in Washington, but it could be. And another thing they talk about is, you mentioned that, actually, Jim DiEugenio mentions that de Morenschild was in Washington in the spring of 63, and he got a $300,000 payment in his bank account, possibly as a payoff, and some people have taken offense at that. But, I mean, these things are out there, and it is responsible. I think if you hadn't put those in there, people would have thought the film is too soft on her. You know, you have to confront people with hard questions, even if they deflect them or don't answer them. And one thing I think is good in your film is, you know, you have to read films visually as well as verbally, and some people just listen to the words. But you do a thing where you, with Ruth and some other people, you linger on her face after she answers the question, you don't just cut away right away, and you linger on her face and you show the eyes kind of darting around, and I think that's very good because you kind of let people study her, and you can draw inferences. But again, she's an enigmatic person, and you also mentioned at the end that there are still documents relating to the Paines that are secret, which is suspicious, right? What do you think of that?
Yeah, there are still some documents classified. Their tax returns are part of the investigation papers, and those are have not been released. There's a little debate over whether those are classified or just withheld under IRS law. But you can imagine that we do not have all the documents about Ruth Paine's sister, Sylvia Hoke, working at the CIA. We do not have all the documents that exist or existed about her father and him being recruited for a CIA assignment in Vietnam in 1957, or whatever other work he was doing as part of USAID. And, all the documents related to Mexico City that tie into to Ruth's involvement with that story. I don't think we have all that stuff. I'm not sure what's part of the last batch of documents that haven't been declassified, or what's been destroyed already.
That's one thing about the case I found as a researcher, that a lot of the evidence has been destroyed and some of the witnesses have been killed or threatened. And you also have to take every document and every piece of testimony in the film skeptically, because there's so much disinformation that some documents have been altered. And the only way to get a handle on it is to do a mosaic of all the different things that you can find and draw some conclusions. And you do that in your film, but you can't rely on there may be no smoking gun in the National Archives, but I found some smoking guns related to the assassination and important things about Tippit. So some things do survive. But it as often people say, if this were a lone gunman with no apparent motive, the Warren Commission couldn't find a motive, why are so many documents hidden away for national security reasons after almost 60 years? It is very strange. The CIA persuaded President Trump not to release a lot of documents, the FBI too, right before legally he was obligated to do it, although the president can still withhold some documents. And Biden himself, and this wasn't really talked about much, but it's in your film, he went along with the agency and kept the documents secret. I believe this fall there's another deadline coming up to release the documents. But Earl Warren, as you quoted in your film, said the documents will be released eventually, but perhaps not in your lifetime, which caused a lot of alarm. So it is suspicious that they're hiding documents. One reason that they're allowed to hide certain documents is to protect sources and methods. If a document mentions the name of a CIA agent, the person's life could be in jeopardy. But after 60 years, a lot of the people are dead or retired. And I found documents about George H.W. Bush being in the CIA and having connections with the assassination, and I caused quite a stir by printing some of those. But then I found that some documents were removed from the National Archives and the Securities and Exchange Commission soon after Bush became vice president. That's another thing they do. So the whole story of the Paines is still being withheld by the government, which is very suspicious in itself, I think.
Yeah, I'm not sure if some of this stuff will be released after Ruth passes away. Michael Paine died in 2018. Ruth is 90 years old, but she's very, she's very sharp and healthy, and I wish her a long life. We'll see what's released with these last documents, if we get anything more, or they just kick the can down the road even further, like they've done since 2017.
Yeah. Even though we have millions of pages of documents have been released thanks to the JFK Assassination Records Review Board, and Oliver Stone's JFK prompted that by putting that in the end notes of the film, that a lot of documents are being withheld, so they were embarrassed into starting this commission. I wanted to ask you a couple of other points. One thing that really struck me as ironic in the film, Max Holland, who is a CIA-connected lone nut advocate, says in the film very smugly, well, there couldn't have been a coup in the United States of America. It just couldn't happen here, you know, and or an attempted coup to replace the president. And we've already had not only the coup of 63, which he denies, but now even the Washington Post and the New York Times are admitting that what happened on January 6, 2021 is a coup attempt. So that was kind of funny, wasn't it? I mean, that Max Holland has already been proven wrong, obviously.
Yeah, Max Holland's a interesting character. He wrote an article that was published on the CIA website called "The Lie That Connected the CIA to the JFK Assassination," or something like that. And it was called the subtitle was "The Power of Disinformation." So yeah, he's interesting character. You find sometimes some sort of CIA connection. Also, Priscilla Johnson McMillan in the film has her own connections to the CIA, and she was an important character who, I guess Jim DiEugenio has been pointing out that it seemed to him like the Oswalds were their handlers were George DeWarren Schultz, and then they were handed off to Ruth and Michael Payne, and then Marina was handed to Priscilla Johnson McMillan. After
she's
that.
She's a very odd person. I noticed the way you filmed her was interesting, because sometimes she comes off looking rather deranged with her eyes kind of widening in a strange way. And you filmed her from kind of a side angle with one of her eyes in shadow. She still looks rather bizarre, but it makes her look a little more real. But she's obviously CIA connected, and she interviewed Oswald in Russia, and she, the next morning after the assassination, started telling that to the press, and they reprinted her article, and she made some modifications in what Oswald told her. And what was it like interviewing her?
She was very open. She was nice. I went to interview her in Boston. She lived right there in Cambridge near Harvard, where she had gone to school, and so she worked for years. And she was a good interview, open, and she never, when I started bringing up some of these CIA things and this document that calls her a witting collaborator, she never got angry. She was always in good humor about everything. So I appreciated that. And I think after the interview, she even told me, she complimented me. She said, "Very good questions," or something like that. So that was nice.
She does some things.
She passed away. She died not too long ago, last few years. Yeah.
Can I just jump? I wanted to ask, she had, when you were talking to her, you asked about a book she had done earlier, and was it Stalin's Daughter, who had defected, and she wrote, ghost wrote her book, or co-wrote her book?
That's right. So she, and it goes even deeper than that. Stalin's Daughter, sort of lived with Priscilla Johnson McMillan. They stayed at her dad's place in Long Island, and I believe her dad owned the Dow Jones Company or something, you know. So she was very, you know, tight with Stalin's daughter after she defected. She was the person living with her, you know, handling her. And she was the translator of this book that Stalin's daughter put out. And, you know, I'm not sure how involved she was with writing it, but it's totally possible that, you know, they kind of developed the book together.
She admits that in her film that it was a CIA project. She claims she didn't know that until later, but obviously the CIA was involved in getting the daughter to come to America and protecting her and shepherding her to be babysat by this CIA-connected person who, as one of the documents in the film shows, they said, we can get her to write whatever we want, basically. She's one of the many media people who moonlight for the CIA, either being agents or doing favors for them. Carl Bernstein wrote a great article called The CIA and the Media in 1977 for Rolling Stone, which you can read online on Bernstein's website. And he said at the time there were about 400 members of the press in America who were CIA connected. Very shows you how pervasive it is, and that could be one of the main reasons why even today the New York Times and the Washington Post, the most important papers in the country, maintain the cover up. And they lie to us frequently about, you know, they just say Oswald did it. They don't even say he was alleged to have done it or anything. And but the media are very culpable. And so your film is a media project, but it's also about the media to some extent, because Ruth Payne collaborates with the media, and Johnson McMillan did a book on Marina and Lee, which helps further the cover story. And so these people are all part of the, as a friend of mine calls it, the media industrial complex. Let me ask you a couple of questions. You mentioned at the end of the film, you have a fair use citation. Now, a number of documentarians have relied on the fact that fair use can allow you to quote parts of a film, just like in a book you can quote up to certain words, a number of words, without permission. And that's an important issue. And did you rely on that? You use things, for example, there were two clips from the Zapruder film showing the headshot. And I know the Sixth Floor Museum is very difficult. They often won't let people show clips from the film, and if they do, they charge them a lot of money. And the Zapruder film was taken by the government, but they have the film, but they paid $16 million to the Zapruder family, which is an astronomical amount of money for the film. But inexplicably, they didn't keep the copyright, which the public should have the copyright. So they gave the copyright, they gave it back to the Zapruder family, who gave it to the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas, which is a disinformation center. But did you rely on fair use to use those clips, as well as clips from many television programs, for example, that you use in the film?
Yeah, I relied almost completely on fair use out of necessity, because my budget was so low. There's no way I could have paid for all the archival footage in this film. You know, mm-hmm. that it probably would have been $200,000 or something just to pay for that, the licensing for all that stuff. But I had one of the best fair use lawyers in the country. He basically, you know, one of the people who wrote the book on this stuff. And we went through the film several times, you know, shot by shot, explaining why I'm using it, what's the argument, where we think it came from. Fair use is important, and a lot of people, you know, you can get away with doing it and publishing your stuff online. But if you're trying to get real distribution, like on Amazon or TV or you know, certain things, they require you to have a certain kind of insurance where you are actually going to have to get a lawyer to go through and verify that you're covered under fair use. And then you can get an insurance contract. Sixth Floor Museum is interesting. They own a ton of footage and photographs related to the assassination. They own the Zapruder film and also those black and white interviews with Ruth and Michael that are in my film. So, I depended on fair use for that. They've asked for some money and I'm going to pay them, you know, a small amount of money, to make sure everything is kosher with distributing the film.
Mm-hmm. So Amazon didn't have any problem accepting your film because it's on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, no problem accepting it.
That's good.
Mm-hmm.
We have about 7 minutes before we have to wrap up, but I just wanted to inject one thing. Did you have, every time Ruth Payne spoke or her husband, it's always Oswald was looking for all of this grand, you know, grandeur and looking for all of this attention. If I tried to make that case, just, you know, for the devil's advocate, I couldn't make it. What do you think of the fact that they say that? And then we have about 6 minutes left and we have to cut out for another show.
Yeah, I think Jim DiEugenio in the film makes an argument that Oswald, if he was looking for fame by killing the president, he would have taken credit for it and not denied it. Yeah, when you see him in custody, the footage of him in custody denying it, saying he's just a patsy, and you know, I emphatically deny these charges, and saying he wants legal representation. He doesn't appear to be the kind of person who is trying to be some infamous, notorious, you know, assassin in history. I'm not convinced by that argument at all.
And just,
I think, yeah.
Okay, no, I was just going to say, when you're done with your answer, if you guys could plug your work again and tell us where to watch the film again and where people can get Joe's books. We have just about 5 minutes before another show cuts in.
Yeah, I think you handle in the film very well. You show Oswald's midnight press conference and you have him saying, "I didn't shoot anybody, no sir." And I found out he was not even arraigned for the Kennedy killing. He was charged with both murders, Tippit and Kennedy, but he was only arraigned for the Tippit murder. And Henry Wade and Jim Lavelle, the lead detective in the Tippit case, told me that Will Fritz, the captain of homicide in Dallas, told them on the night of the assassination, "We don't have much of a case, if any case, on him for killing Oswald, so let's get him on the Tippit murder." They admitted that to me, and I said to Lavelle, "What evidence do you have for the Tippit murder that's different?" He said, "Well, we had witnesses." He's implying they didn't have witnesses for the Kennedy murder, even though they later produced one who they claimed saw it. But even in the Tippit case, the witnesses are all conflicted. So Oswald was never even arraigned for the Kennedy murder, and they knew the case was very tenuous. So when Ruth keeps turning up this evidence, it was very important to them to keep finding more so-called evidence, as he called it. You mentioned that Ruth hasn't seen the final film, and I guess is not interested. But did she see any version of it? You said you did a 20-minute version, and does she see a rough version of the long version too?
No, as far as I know, she hasn't seen any version of the film. And
have you had contact with her since the film came out at all, and saying, "Do you want to see the film" or anything like that?
No, the last time I talked to her, in 2019, she made it clear that she didn't want to be involved and or filmed anymore. And I decided that I was not going to bug her anymore or ask her for anything. And I assumed, yeah, she might not want to see the film, and I don't want to harass her. So I didn't reach out to her, share it or propose anything. If she wants to see it, I'm happy to show her a copy. I've seen what other people have posted stuff online who are in touch with her, saying that she's not interested, she doesn't really care about it, and she doesn't want to see it.
Burke Griffin.
I respect that choice, and I don't think people should be bugging her and saying, you know, telling her, oh, there's this movie out, this is saying terrible things about you. You know, just leave her alone. Don't talk about it if she doesn't want to hear about it.
I want to thank you guys for being here, but we just have 90 seconds. If you want to plug your books and where we can watch the film again, thanks for being on. We just have about a little over 1 minute if you guys want to do that.
Max, tell us where you can see the film.
Thanks, Bob. So you can see the film. It's called The Assassination of Mrs. Payne on Amazon, iTunes, a bunch of other places. And my website is jfkpayne.com. I'm also on Twitter and Facebook.
And Joe,
I recommend the film very highly. It's a wonderful film, very balanced and very full of information. And my books are Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit, and more recently, Political Truth, the Media, and the Assassination of President Kennedy, which deals with films as well as books and newspapers, etc. Those books are both available on Amazon, so I hope you pursue the case further, and the film will get you interested in reading more about these people.
Well, Joe's book, Into the Nightmare, I think is a classic. It's a must-read in Kennedy assassination literature. First-person research he did, some incredible interviews in there. This piece of work we've just been talking about is essential. I think everybody who's into the research in the assassination should just go out and watch it today. And I thank these guys for being here, and I hope they will be back again, and we'll see you again next week.